Then he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered, "The Christ of God." And he strictly charged and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised." And he said to all, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world, yet loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory, and the glory of the Father, and the glory of the holy angels. But I tell you truly, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God." Now about 8 days after these sayings, he took up with them Peter and John and James, and went up on the mountain to pray. And as he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered, and his clothing became dazzling white. And behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish in Jerusalem. Now Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. And as the men were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents for you, and one for Moses and one for Elijah," not knowing what he said. As he was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud, saying, "This is my Son, my chosen one. Listen to him." And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. And they kept silent and told no one in those days anything of what they had seen.
Alexa, thank you for reading, and let me add my welcome to Phil's. My name's Kev, I'm the minister of the church. Really good to have you with us this Sunday evening. Phil mentioned that this is our Giving Sunday, one Sunday in the year when we focus on partly our finances as a church. We do that unashamedly. Christian giving is a normal and necessary part of Christian discipleship. The Bible has lots to say about how we use our money. Luke's Gospel does, we'll see as we go on over the following weeks. And partly a week like this is just a great opportunity for us to look back with thanks and to reflect on what our vision and mission is together as a church. It's worth saying at the start, my job at this point is not to be the Terry Wogan figure on the Children in Need telethon, if you've seen that. Or to use any of the clever strategies, you know, the students in Rag Week who rattle the bucket dressed as a gorilla. We decided to avoid that one. Or the charity muggers down at King's Cross Station. Have you worked out how to avoid them? The way they catch me is with flattery. So they'll say, "Ah, really nice jumper." And I'll always fall for it. "Ah, thank you. Yes, I heard that Navy was in this season. And they've hooked me into the conversation." Well, none of those tricks tonight, I hope. Our remit is actually much broader than just thinking about money. Our aim is more ambitious than just that we'll all empty our wallets at the end of the night. Verse 23 in our reading is what Jesus wants to persuade us to do today and every day. Verse 23, "And he said to all, 'If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me.'" I've certainly felt the weight of those words this week as I prepared. Very challenging. And it feels like this is an important passage for us as a church. The aim is that as individuals, as married folk, if that's us, and as a whole church together, we will recommit ourselves to this kind of radical, cross-shaped discipleship. So shall I pray that that will happen before we get into this? Our Father God, these are hard and challenging verses. We need your help to understand them and much more to live them. So please be our helper. Help us to trust Jesus as we listen to him. Amen. This is partly just the latest in our series in Luke's Gospel as we've been tracking through it. We always do Giving Sunday at this time of year, so we decided rather than go to a different part of the Bible for a one-off talk, that this passage seemed appropriate. We mentioned last week there would be huge demands made here, but as always in the Christian life, we don't begin with us doing stuff. We begin with Jesus. So that's why our first point is the Son of Man must die. We had this great high point last week where someone finally joined up the dots on the most important question in all of life. Verse 20. Then he said to them, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered, "The Christ of God." You're the promised one, Jesus, that we've been waiting for. It's a great moment of realization, but it becomes quite a weird moment as Jesus replies in, well, not the way that a small group leader is supposed to when somebody gets the right answer. Verse 21, basically, right, answer Peter, but don't you dare tell anyone. He strictly charged them not to tell people who he is. Strange evangelism training by Jesus. And the problem here is he hasn't yet explained to his disciples what kind of Christ he's going to be. Christ means king, and we've seen tasters of the fact that that means a kingdom oozing with life and health and bread that satisfies forever. Great, let's get on with the kingdom, Jesus, let's go for it. Well, no. Verse 22, "Because the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed." And have you zoned out yet? I think I have, even as I read it there. It's so familiar, isn't it? We know exactly what will happen to Jesus. But the shock here is that this is the Christ who will suffer and be rejected and be killed. And that is supposed to be the single most shocking and extraordinary idea in history. To get why it's such a shock, we need to remember who the Son of Man is. That's the phrase Jesus uses for himself. It's his favourite phrase for himself in the Gospels. And one of the good things about the Bible is it's really its own Wikipedia. So if you want to know what something like that means, the Son of Man, there'd usually be a place you could look up in the Bible and it would give you the definition. Well, the book of Daniel, chapter 7, is the clearest definition. I put it on the sheet there, and I'm sorry not to put the verse references. It's Daniel 7, verses 13 and 14 there on the sheet. This is what it says about the Son of Man. "I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and people of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." It's a pretty impressive title, isn't it? In the 1970s, there was a dictator called Idi Amin, and he had a pretty impressive title. This was it: His Excellency, President for Life, Field Marshal Dr. Idi Amin, VC, DSO, MC, this is the best bit, Lord of all the beasts of the earth and fishes of the sea and conqueror of the British Empire in Africa. He had that title bestowed on him by himself, actually. He was quite a humble kind of guy in that sense. Well, this is a title that is much more impressive, and it's all true. Sovereign President, King of all people, forever. This is the one who actually is the Lord of the beasts and the fishes of the sea. Do you remember the fishing miracle in Luke's Gospel? His Excellency, His Majesty, the Son of Man. I imagine we measure power in units of David Cameron. We'll call him Cameron. So Nick Clegg, he'd be, what would he be, about a fifth of a Cameron or a tenth? I don't know. We better not get too political. Obama, he'd be, you know, a lot of Cameron, 100 Camerons. Don't want to do us down too much. Maybe even more. How many Camerons is the Son of Man? Now, what size of car would be appropriate? How much red carpet would be the right amount to roll out This is talking about Jesus. He's power like you couldn't imagine. Coming on the clouds. Not just ruler of all people, picture him in the Oval Office of the universe, directing the galaxies. And now picture that same individual flogged, spat at, nailed to a tree naked, and completely alone. Isn't that just deeply, deeply wrong? Well, Jesus will go on to triumph. He says in that same verse, he will rise. And verse 26, well, that chimes precisely with the quote from Daniel, the glory, the angels as the Son of Man comes on the clouds to bring in his everlasting kingdom. But first, he must suffer. Jesus' journey to glory has to go via the cross if he's going to do the job he came to do. The cross will be explained more fully as we track through Luke's gospel, so we won't say everything about it now. But it is worth us just pausing here for a moment on a week when we're reflecting on our mission as a church. And you know, the cross is the only thing that we have to boast in as a church. I'm really glad it's on our little logo, isn't it? Right at the heart of the way we write our church name. I'm glad about that. It reminds me that it's at the heart of our message. The glory of God at the cross. The relief of the cross, the forgiveness that it brings us. We come by the blood. We have no other way to God. The hope for the world that lies in the cross. Here is the health warning. Please do not attempt to do verse 23 until you've understood verse 22. Great to talk about our giving. Great to talk about sacrifices that people are making. But the defining thing about being a Christian is nothing to do with things that we are sacrificing for God, and everything to do with what he has sacrificed for us. The Son of Man must suffer and die for your sake. And yet, almost maybe uncomfortably quickly for us, Jesus is not afraid to immediately apply this new idea to what it will mean for his followers. Following the king of the world, you know, someone who really is the king of the world, you know, that would be great, wouldn't it? Maybe get a job as one of his special advisors, government car. You know, I could rule a little bit of your world for you, if you like, Jesus. Just a little corner, you know, Bermuda maybe, somewhere like that. Verse 23, Jesus to them and Jesus to us. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Yeah, following a dying, suffering king of the world, that is something else again. And it is kind of Jesus to be so upfront. It's kind of him to tell us that there'll be a cost in discipleship. Kind of us to show us the pattern of the Christian life. Now, that's what the Nike swoosh is for. You've probably, if you've been here before, seen that before. It's the shape of the swoosh that is the point there. So the Christian life is one where you go down the curve to go up the curve. Death to life. Suffering leads to glory that will follow. And, you know, actually understanding that trajectory is, I think, one of the most important things in the whole of the Christian life. Do you know what I worry about for you? I worry about this as a church sometimes. I worry for myself. The thing I worry about is the day that comes, it might be soon, or it might be in the future, when it feels too tough following Jesus, and you think about giving up. The parable of the sower that we saw a few weeks ago, it teaches me to worry about that. It says that not every keen young Christian person in church would be one who would want to keep going when life gets tough. And I think actually we won't keep going as faithful believers unless we're convinced that that pattern of suffering to glory is the normal pattern and experience of the Christian life. Not just for Jesus, not just for the super apostles or the uber keen. He said to all, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself. Lent has just started, hasn't it? There might be some perfectly good reasons for denying yourself something like chocolate during Lent. But that is not what Jesus is talking about here. Not deny yourself something. Deny yourself. Give up your claim to ownership of your life completely. And I think it makes sense that Jesus would say that straight after verse 22, because me living the me life with me at the centre and all the ugly consequences of that, well, that is precisely why the Son of Man must die. To come to Jesus for forgiveness, that would mean to renounce that whole approach completely and reordering life not with me in the driving seat, but with him. Give control of your life to Jesus, then, is what's been asked of us here. And take up your cross. It was a horrible over-the-top thing, crucifixion in Roman times. The only reason that anyone would be carrying a cross would be to the point of your own execution. I guess probably just mentioning the word sent a shudder down the spines of Jesus' original listeners. Lots of them would have seen one live. Well, this is Jesus' best object lesson for what it means to be a disciple. Picture a Roman executioner with his lump of wood, and you're in the right ballpark for the Christian life. Just so we're clear, take up your cross doesn't mean die for your own sins. And it's not even mainly about becoming a martyr. You know, there have been eras in church history where basically people took it a bit too far, tried to become a martyr, because they thought that that was the fast track to glory. I guess that's not really our problem in our culture, is it? It does mean martyrdom for some. They say thousands of Christians, the estimates are, every year, give up their life just for being a Christian. But notice that Jesus says, take up your cross daily. He's asking us to do something very normal that we incorporate into our ordinary daily life. The way of life for the Christ is the way for the Christian as well. We were praying this morning at the Sunday morning service for Muslim people who become Christians and then are persecuted. Some of them completely ostracized by their whole family when they start following Jesus. You'd need some really good reasons, wouldn't you, to take up your cross in that way. But actually, even in the smaller decisions of our lives, how we sacrifice things like time and money, for Jesus' sake, we need some good reasons to do it. So before we get into the detail of what that might mean for us, I think it would be important that it would be really clear that following in Jesus' footsteps is the path to life. This is us on our second point, if you're following on the sheet. I wonder if you've heard of a guy called Bill Jaracki. A few years ago, he was faced with the horrible choice between hypothermia and blood loss that would lead to death, or cutting his leg off with a penknife. He was trapped on a remote mountain with his leg under a boulder, and to save his life, he basically had to saw through his knee with a Swiss Army knife. Sorry, that's a pretty horrible thing to mention. There's an article by him called What It's Like to Cut Your Own Leg Off, which I hope you never have to read as a manual. Something you're doing yourself. Straight choice, keep his leg and lose his life, or give up his leg and save his life. Hard thing to do the right thing there. Bill Jaracki is a hero. But actually not that difficult, is it, to know what was the right choice that he should make. And Jesus presents us with a choice like that here, where it's very hard to do the right thing, but actually fairly simple when you see it put out, what the right choice would be. Cling on to the me life, and you'll lose everything. Give up your life, and you will live forever. It sounds simple, doesn't it? It's just that the problem is so many people live the verse 25 life. See verse 25? That's the language of profit and loss. And it could just sound quite sort of like crude accounting and a bad financial decision. But it's actually a tragedy, isn't it? Verse 25. That is the tragedy of the person who tries to gain the world. Not in the Dr. Evil sense of trying to take it over, just trying to gain everything that this world would want to offer. That's why so many people are here in London, isn't it? It's why people come to the big city. Humanly speaking, you can gain the whole world in a city like this. And so I want us to imagine, just for a minute, a story. Imagine an undergraduate who arrives in London as a student. It all goes really well for him in his student days. He's popular, group of friends, good at his studies as well. He gets a first. And that means that he's able to then move on to a plum job over in the city. He marries a pretty girl. They move out of town, have kids. He's doing well enough in the job in the city that they can send their kids to a really good school. He then gets to the top of his firm. Fast forward a few more years, the kids are now grown up. They start to have kids. And our former undergraduate is now in his 50s, doing so well at work that he can afford to retire. He has a great retirement, full of holidays and fun with his grandchildren. And his wife, who he still thinks looks like a pretty girl, even though she's getting on a bit. He did everything they say on the list, 100 things to do before you die. He swam with dolphins. He did it all. And then sometime at a ripe old age, our former undergraduate passes away, peacefully, warm in his bed. But then he meets the Son of Man. And the conversation is horrible as the realization begins to dawn. It really felt like he'd had it all as he went through life. But it turns out that he missed out on the one thing that really mattered about this life. He never asked for forgiveness, never gave up control to Jesus. The way of the cross. Well, that had sounded so pathetic when he heard it. I think that verse 25 is one of the saddest verses in the whole Bible, isn't it? I'm going to read it in a second. And it's really gutting, I think, verse 25, because it is the path that so many in our city are on. It's the path that lots of people that we know and love are on. Life is going so well for them. But verse 25, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself, his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory. And that being ashamed there, that's not talking about Christians who might be tempted to feel a bit embarrassed about Jesus every now and then. It's people who've decided to disassociate from Jesus and his shameful cross as they've made that decision in this life. And in a sense, ultimately we get what we want, in a sense, because reject Jesus in this life, and ultimately he will disown you to a lost eternity. Well, they're really big, sobering realities, aren't they, that we're thinking about this evening. It's very strong stuff. But that tragic story and tragic future is not what Jesus wants for people. I hope we go on and on about the cross a lot at Euston Church. And I hope too that we go on and on to the people of London about eternity. It's a very simple job to help people see this simple profit and loss decision and to pray that they will make the wise one. Verse 24 sums it up. Whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. It's really huge, isn't it, what Jesus is demanding from us here. And that's the reason that the exercise we talked about right at the end last week is so, so important. Can we trust him as he says that that's the way the world works? The transfiguration that we read on into there, we haven't got time to look at now, is God the Father's way of saying, yes, you can trust him. This really is my chosen one. Listen to him. Feel free to ask more about that incident in the question time if you like. Luke, we know, wants us to be certain that when Jesus offers us the path for life, we can't trust him. The sin forgiver, the illness healer, the evil banisher, the storm calmer, the bread provider. We can trust the death reverser when he says, lose your life now and I will save it forever. So finally, let's think about some of the detail as we take up our cross daily. Now, we'll always fail to do that as we try, but the forgiven person who's come to Jesus resolves to be in this battle. And the bar is, it's just so high, isn't it? It's been a huge challenge to me as I've looked at this week. Feel free to ask me more about that in the question time too. We can't control lots of the big ways that people could hurt us because we follow Jesus. But this daily battle to deny self is a choice that we all make, and in lots of very ordinary looking ways. So denying self means it's Jesus' time, not Kev's time. My job is his job. My stuff is his stuff. And it all being for Jesus' sake, that's an important thing it says there. It means it's not just any sacrifice or anything that makes us feel, that was hard work and rubbish. It's about sacrifices that serve his interests. So what does Jesus think I should be ambitious about, for example? What does he think would be important about my time at university or what I do with my body? And the fact that it's the way of the cross means that we should expect that there will be pain as we make those decisions, which, to be honest, even in the really small details, will look very radical, won't it? In a city where concepts like sacrifice and the future being more important than now, well, those are often just very alien things. So what about our money? Well, it means it stops being mine, doesn't it? It belongs to him, not just 10% or a little bit of it that I decide to give away, all of it. So if I save, I'll be thinking, what does Jesus say about what would be worth saving for? And as I give, I'll be thinking, well, it's not about just what's left over after I've bought all the stuff that I wanted to have anyway. I know cross-shaped Christian giving will be really sacrificial. It will eat into my social budget, my gadget budget, if I have one, every bit of the budget. There'll be a real cost. And even the things that I do decide to buy, I'll be wanting to use for Jesus' sake. It's been a real joy for me these last few days reflecting on this and thanking the Lord for the privilege of being in a church where so many people clearly believe this stuff and are trying to walk this way. Cranson, our treasurer, is going to be speaking to us in a few minutes. He and I were chatting the other day and he was saying that one of his work colleagues was just blown away to think that a young crowd like this was giving away so much money for Jesus' sake. It's great. And it's not just money. Think of people saying, these are Jesus' gifts to be used for the gospel. This is Jesus' time. Of course I'm going to give up big chunks of it to serve the church in different ways, to lead, to help others, even if they're very different from me. And, just some of the sheer manpower and labor that goes on to make the things happen in our church that do happen. It's really astonishing. Some in the church family facing real costs at work, in relationships, for Jesus' sake. Others saying, well, it's his life. So as I plan what I'm going to do next, where I'm going to be next. Some deciding to stay in London for Jesus' sake, for the opportunities here. Some like Andre deciding to move away from London because of opportunities elsewhere. It's great to reflect on all of that. To God be the glory. It's his work in us that makes that happen. But the bar here is so, so high, isn't it? And I've just been challenged to think it's just very easy to become quite comfortable in that sense. And so I think it's a good thing for all of us to review more generally how we're doing in the cross-shaped life that Jesus demands of his followers. And in particular, could I ask all of us to, as one application of this talk, review our money and our finances according to these principles. These principles are the things that I've been thinking about in that area myself these last few days. So am I denying self with my money? Am I using it for Jesus' sake? And is there a real cost to me as I walk this way of the cross? Now, some of us won't have the capacity to give more, but I'm just guessing. I guess that lots of us maybe would. And it is just worth reflecting that the opportunities that we have together to do things for Jesus' sake in this area are massive. You know, there's nowhere else in the UK, maybe nowhere else in Europe, are there so many students and people from so many different countries all over the world in such a concentrated space than the 4 or 5 miles around our area here. We're at the middle of it. The world has come to us. In that sense, it's exciting, and it's a real responsibility for us as a church family to make the most of the ministry opportunities that we have here. And we're not about covering deficits at the church. When Cranston gets up to speak, he'll be clear on that as well. It's not about meeting a certain budget. Basically, the more that we can give, the more that we're able then to do to make the most of those opportunities. So just to mention 3 things that we're not doing at the moment that we'd love to do. First, on the international stuff that Andre mentioned. Basically, Maxime and Demelza have been sort of free to us in that sense this year, this last couple of years. It's been a real blessing to us. They're moving on in the summer. And we want to be able to replace the work that Maxime has been doing because that part of the ministry is so important and growing. We'll probably need to put a little money aside if we were going to get somebody to take over that role. Think of Maxime and Demelza themselves. They're going back to train for Bible teaching ministry in French-speaking Europe. That's a part of the world that we already have a connection with our mission partners, Alex and Sarah Manlow. We'd love to support Maxime and Demelza financially in the same way going forward in the future. And training, it was great to hear about the training stuff going on. The other thing to say on that is that it's exciting that every year of our church family life, some people have explored full-time Christian ministry by going to do an apprenticeship scheme over at St. Helen's Church, our sending church, and the Cornhill training course as well. Now that's great. The way it's worked so far is that people who've done that have tended to be people who've been able to raise finances themselves. We'd love to, in a church like this where I think lots of us should be exploring full-time Christian ministry in that way, we'd love to let more people explore that who maybe have the gifts but not necessarily the money to fund themselves through that. So we could put a lot of money into those 3 areas, or we could put just a little bit. It'd be a good marker for us, I think, to start to say we want to invest in those things, international ministry, French-speaking Europe, and the training ministry that's already going on. We haven't, as I say, got any money budgeted or set aside for any of those things at the moment. But wouldn't it be a brilliant thing to give sacrificially, to give some more, to be able to facilitate those works for Jesus' sake? What a joy to be able to invest in important things that will last into eternity. But it's right we say it's a joy, and it is a joy to serve Jesus' way, but the big illustration in this passage is the cross. So expect it to be painful and hard as we make those sacrifices. Well, just as we finish, let's zoom back out from thinking about money in particular. And let me ask you, how are you just generally tempted to feel sorry for yourself if you're someone trying to live the cross-shaped life? Some of the ways that we have to deny self are really painful. It will mean missing out on stuff. It will mean extra hassle in our life. But just look at that line at the bottom of the sheet there. I want you to imagine that dot represents your life on this earth. So the dot is your whole time on earth. And the whole rest of the line is eternity. So your future of health and satisfaction and being with Jesus forever. Sorry, it's meant to go off the page. That's not a theological statement on the right-hand side. That's me not knowing how to use the computer. But it's meant to go all the way on there. And I don't say this lightly because I do know that some of the sacrifices that people in the church family are making. But what sacrifice that you have to make in following Jesus would be too far or not worth it if that future is real? You know, even martyrdom would not be worth comparing to the glory that will follow. that probably won't be it for most of us. Martyrdom probably will just be the less dramatic decision to take up our cross in daily life is what's required. And I'm really excited about the thought of 120 people in here Sunday, Wednesday nights deciding to live that way. What might the Lord do through a bunch of people living their London life for Jesus' sake? And how will we be the ones who keep going all the way? Well, by looking back to the cross and by looking forward to our future with Jesus. We used to sing an old chorus, "Turn your eyes upon Jesus." I don't know if you know it. Maybe it's slightly cheesy for us to sing now, but I think the words are great. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. Amen.